Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
oh, yeah, we did. We started to burn so many things we found. That's what we're going to talk about today. This is Harvey Wasserman back with another hour in Solartopia, the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show here on the PRN-FM radio network. Thanks to the crew in New York for doing this. We have two great guests, two great old buddies of mine that are working in the field of saving the planet, and which has all jumped up another level with the lunatic in the White House now, or I guess he's the lunatic in Trump Towers with his vacation home in the White House. We got Paul Guyp in Bakersfield, California. Paul, are you with us?
Oh, yes. It's good to be with you, Harvey.
Well, thank you, thank you. And Charlie Komanoff in New York City. Charlie, are you with us?
Yeah, how you guys doing?
We're great. So we got a full hour here to run through the Trumpocalypse and what's going on here. But first, I do want to talk to you, Charlie. You went down, I believe, to the from New York City. You took your family down on the train to the Women's March in or the however you want to call it. I guess it primarily is a Women's March, but
yeah, well,
you're not a woman.
Let's call it the Women's March because it was, you know, conceived, organized, led, and energized by women, and that's a terrific thing.
So tell us about it. What was it like? What was the day like in D.C.? Of course, there was a really small turnout, according to Donald Trump, but maybe you can have an opinion on that. I heard there was actually nobody there.
Yeah, actually, Harvey, I got to confess that, you know, we went down Thursday night, and so Friday, you know, we did some demonstrating in ragtag fashion, you know, during the day, during the installation of Trump. And then we got to spend the rest of the afternoon at the new National Museum of African American History and Culture, you know, the Blacksonian. That's a whole other amazing trip in itself. And then Saturday morning, due to just some, like, stupid logistics, I had to take the bus up back to New York City while my wife and older son were able to stay and do the Women's March in D.C. But I got back early enough to get back to my apartment, get on my bike, and, you know, pedal up to Midtown so I could join the Women's March in the heart of Manhattan on Fifth Avenue, just like a dozen blocks south of Trump Tower. And, wow, the energy is just, it was and is, and it's got to stay absolutely fantastic. And, you know, for me, it's not about the speakers, although I hear that the speakers down in D.C. were amazing. It's about the outpouring and the signs and just the incredible unity and diversity of everybody who turned out in like 500 different cities across the country. The total numbers, you know, there's a Google spreadsheet going around that's very well documented, well over 3 million people. 1% of the entire U.S. population demonstrating last Saturday, January 21st, against this dictator to be in the White House. So, you know, I'm, as you can tell, I'm pretty encouraged.
Well, now, are those the same 3 million people that swam across the Rio Grande and voted illegally for Hillary Clinton?
Yeah, that's
no, no, Harvey, those are all in California. They're called Democrats.
Oh, okay.
Hopefully not for long.
Yeah. I mean, it gets wilder and wilder. And today he is says he's going to put an import tax to pay for the wall. That's going to be really interesting. I actually chose to stay home and write on the day of the women's marches. And I guess it's a good thing I did because the article did go up on Huffington Post and Reader Supported News and a few other places. So I guess I got my 2 cents with him, but they really look fantastic. They are the biggest post immediately post-inaugural marches in the history of the United States, and among the biggest coordinated marches in the history of the United States.
So I think we not only should celebrate this, as Charles mentioned, but we should also thank Herr Trump for stimulating us to action. We can at least thank him for one thing that he's done. He's pulled us together to say, you know, it's time that we need to take action in this country. And one of the things that we can take action on is the infrastructure plans. Infrastructure has been avoided. Investments in infrastructure in the United States have been avoided for decades, and Trump put his finger on it during the campaign. We need to invest in infrastructure. Well, we know who's been stopping investment infrastructure. It certainly wasn't the Democrats. We love to spend money, as they say. And I think there's a real opportunity here, Harvey, that it's not going to be pretty. Politics is not a pretty thing, and particularly right now, it's a pretty messy, ugly experience. But they're going to be throwing a lot of money around in D.C., and that swamp is going to get really, really deep. But there could be some money for some of the things we want to do. And so some of us are going to have to dirty our hands and get in there and make sure that we get that money for what we want.
Well, what do we want? Charlie is our leading expert on carbon tax and the carbon issue. And, Paul, you have a new book out, a gorgeous book. Thank you for sending it to me. Tell us about this book before. I don't want to lose track of it. And, of course, wind would be our infrastructure. In fact, I saw a very interesting piece that said that the wall that Trump should build along the Mexican border should be solar panels. And if he put a solar wall or a solar fence or a string of solar panels all the way across from Brownsville, Texas to Tijuana there, that would be a pretty cool thing. But tell us about your book first and where, how it fits in to this question of infrastructure.
Well, the title of the book is politically provocative. It's deliberately so. The title is Wind Energy for the Rest of Us. That is, we as Americans, we as Canadians in North America here, but we as citizens of countries that need renewable energy should have the right to develop real renewable energy for our own benefit. And if there's going to be a massive infrastructure development, then we need, and we know that Electricity de France, Florida Power Light, all the typical people that we expect will be going in there money grubbing for projects that they want to build, we should make sure that we get money to build projects for us, for farmers in Indiana. Yeah, a lot of those farmers voted for Trump, but they have a right to wind energy as well as we do here in California. So the title of my book, Wind Energy for the Rest of Us, says that wind energy, and of course other forms of renewable energy, should be developed by the people, for the people, for the benefit of the people. It's our resource. The wind and solar energy is our resource. We should use it, and we should get paid to use it.
Well, I like that. Who's the publisher of your book, and where do we get the book?
You can get the book wherever books are sold. Amazon's, it's available. It's in digital form as well. Anywhere you want to buy this book, you'll find it's available.
Okay. Well, I'm going to be over at Trump Tower next week. Is there a copy there in the lobby?
Let me know, and I'll have one expressed over there for the Donald.
All right, okay. So it's available online in digital form as well as in paper.
Yes, you've seen the print version, and of course it's a massive book, 560 pages, weighs 3 pounds. If nothing else, it makes a hell of a doorstop.
Yeah, well, let's hope it makes a stop on the destruction of our planet. Charlie Kovanoff, what is happening in the Trump world here with renewable energy and with carbon?
Harvey, you're the moderator, and I should just, answer. But
you've got an echo on your line. Do I have an echo coming on your line from you?
Yeah, a little bit.
Okay.
So maybe you can fix that, if it's bothering your listeners.
No, I like it, actually. It's kind of cool.
I hope that you're gonna, or we're gonna get to talk to Paul about you got to tell your listeners who this man is, that the person who, for the past 40 years and counting, has been,
yes.
You know, I mean, really kind of started the whole movement for wind power in this country and has stayed with it and helped it evolve and has evolved along with it. But I hope we're going to get to ask him, given the huge scale economies with wind turbines, that they're kind of an inverse of, you know, solar collectors, because if you want 10 times the solar power, then you just put in 10 times as many collectors. You know, it's just a linear scale. But with wind turbines, unless I've got my technology, you know, badly wrong, there's far more bang for the buck by going big and really, really big, because not only do the blades have to be huge, but they've got to be high, because, you know, the higher off the ground you are, the stronger the wind is, and there's the lower the cube, which says that the power or the energy that the turbines can pull out of the air and turn into electricity is proportional to the cube of the wind speed. And if you listeners out there haven't forgotten your high school math, that is a big deal. If you double the wind speed by going way up high, then you'd have eight times as much electricity. So how do we reconcile these industrial economies of scale with the community scale ownership and control that we want?
That's an excellent question, Charles. And that's why my book is titled the way it is, because this book has an entire chapter devoted to what I call electricity rebels. It introduces the topic, the subject of electricity rebels, to North American readers. It's an idea that's fairly common in Germany, and if you travel throughout Germany, you'll see wind turbines everywhere, not like in the giant wind farms we see across Kansas and Iowa today here in the United States. Clusters, two, three, four, five, six, half a dozen, couple dozen turbines. Those turbines are typically owned by the people who live nearby, farmers, homeowners, businessmen. It's owned by the people in the community.
And also
what they're able to do is go ahead.
And also, in some cases, by the towns and the villages, you know, by the governments. Right?
Oh,
am I right on that?
By municipal governments,
yeah,
correct.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
small
right.
levels of government, not owned by the federal state.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
Owned by small groups. And so with solar energy, solar panels, you can buy one panel or two, and you can put those on your roof. As Charles mentioned, with a large wind turbine, that's not the way it works. But what you can do is you can get one, two, three hundreds of people to join together to own a wind turbine collectively, cooperatively. You're in it together in a share offering. That's the way it was developed in Denmark. Denmark became the leader in wind energy for many decades, followed by Germany. And over half of all the wind turbines in Germany are owned by people like us on this telephone call, people like the listeners on your radio program, Harvey.
Well, how does that work, Paul? I mean, if a community or a group of individuals wants to own a windmill, how does it work, and do we have examples of this kind of community ownership of wind power in the United States that you can point to?
In the United States, we have examples of municipal ownership. A number of small communities across the United States own wind turbines as municipal utilities. We have some farmer-owned co-ops own some wind turbines in the upper Midwest. It's a very small percentage of the total amount of wind energy in the United States. In Canada, however, we have some very good examples of cooperatively owned wind turbines. A prominent one, which is happens to be the one on the cover of my book, is in downtown Toronto, in urban Toronto. Anyone who flies to Toronto and goes into the city from Pearson Airport drives right past this wind turbine that's at a park on the shore of Lake Ontario. That turbine is owned cooperatively by citizens, responsible citizens in Toronto, who wanted to set an example for how they wanted to see renewable energy developed in Ontario in opposition to the nuclear development that Ontario, 50% of their electricity comes from nuclear, as Harvey probably knows.
Well, it's an interesting prospect. I know a number of Indian tribes are deep into the wind business. How is that going? Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, there's a couple of a couple of bands or tribes in Canada that own their own groups of turbines. There was just a new cooperative put up outside Woodstock, Ontario, owned by farmers and community members. But there's also some clusters of wind turbines owned by some native bands elsewhere in Ontario and also in Nova Scotia. A lot of people are not aware there's quite a few cooperatively owned or community-owned wind turbines in Nova Scotia.
And how are they doing financially and in terms
Actually,
of
those are they're doing quite well. And one of the things that I emphasize in my book, this is not the only way to do it, but this is one way to do it. As I said in my opening gambit, we want the right to develop renewable energy. We're Americans. We demand the right to use our renewable energy, and we demand to be paid for it. We demand to be paid a fair price. And in Nova Scotia, they had a fixed price. And if you build a wind turbine and you sold, you made electricity, you knew exactly the price you'd be paid for that electricity, and they had a good price, and those projects are doing quite well. And one of those is featured in my book.
And what is it?
It's Colchester Cumberland Wind Company in Nova Scotia. They're getting like 10 cents a kilowatt hour.
So what kind of return on investment do we see from these
Something like that you could probably it has to be less than 10 years. You would get the return on investment less than 10 years. I don't want to dwell too much, Harvey, on the specifics of this. I think it's the big picture that we need to grasp here, and we need to grasp that this isn't, even though it's pretty, these are dark times here in the United States, there is opportunity, and we need to grasp what little opportunity there is.
Well, what about there's a tribe in California that has windmills along a ridge in Southern California, and I don't know why the name of the tribe escapes me for the moment. It'll come to me as soon as the show is over. Isn't there tribal-owned wind power in the American West?
Well, there might be some near Palm Springs, and there might be elsewhere in the United States, but it's not significant. I guess what Charles and I would like to talk about is it's very, very difficult to do this politically in the United States, and that's why I introduced this topic of electricity rebels. You have to be a rebel to do this, because our system and our government, our political parties make it nearly impossible to do this. And so if you approached most conservative farmers in Indiana and say, why did you just let a German electric utility company put wind turbines on your land? Yes, you're getting paid to use your land, but why didn't you put the wind turbines there yourself? And the farmer will say, well, I can't do that. Why can't you do that? If you ask the same question of a German farmer, they would say, I can do that. Of course I can do that. Don't tell me I can't do that, because if you tell me I can't do that, I replace the legislator that says I can't until I find one that says I can. And that's, of course, what we're going to have to do here.
Well, what's the principal barrier for people putting in wind turbines?
You have to have the right to install the wind turbine and sell the electricity. We have that. But you also have to have the right to be paid for the electricity. As Charles will tell you, it's one thing to put up a wind turbine. It's another thing to get paid for it.
Well, Charlie, tell us. What's the deal?
You know, I'm sitting here and, you know, trying to keep the top of my head from exploding. This is pretty amazing stuff. You know, and I'm a little appalled at myself that I hadn't been thinking in the terms that Paul has obviously been, you know, researching and compiling and advocating now for a long time. You know, I have more questions than answers. So, you know, now I want to ask Paul if, you know, 500 farmers in some county in Indiana or any other state, you know, got together, formed an association, were able to raise capital, and I know that's a big, you know, if. Depending on the state, in some states they would be, some states would make it easier than others to strike a contract with either a local electricity distribution company or a transmission operator. You know these terms better than I do, but, is it really that difficult? It would seem that most of the pieces ought to be in place.
In principle, they're in place. In principle, they've been in place since the Public Utility Regulatory Policies Act of 1978. Unfortunately, we did some of this during the 1990s in Minnesota, where there were a number of farmer-owned wind projects developed. But we have essentially given the right to develop wind energy and large-scale renewable energy to the utility companies, now to the utility companies' subsidiaries, by going through this process that we call in the United States Renewable Portfolio Standards. The environmental activists have all kinds of grandiose terms for it. Basically, it's a renewable portfolio standard where an individual farmer would have to compete with Electricity de France or Florida Power and Light to put up a wind turbine. Well, you know how that usually turns out. Florida Power and Light or Pacific Gas and Electric wins the contract, and they get the right to build the wind turbine. What they do in Germany, it says, in contrast to that, is if the farmer wants to put up the wind turbine, he doesn't compete with anybody. If he has the land and access to the power line, he can put up the wind turbine and sell the electricity by right.
And that's called a feed-in tariff.
Exactly.
Okay, and you've probably told me this before, Paul, and maybe I just wasn't ready to grapple with it. But so I see the value of the feed-in tariff, which, as you say, is what has kind of enabled Germany to become a world leader, at least, you know, per capita, in both wind and solar electricity production, at least among the major, you know, industrial countries.
And also in biogas and biomass and geothermal. They've been doing it all.
But the value of that is not just that there's a guaranteed price, although that's essential, but that there's a guaranteed purchaser with a guaranteed price of the electricity or the energy that you can manufacture.
Exactly. Those are the two elements you need. You have to have the right to sell the electricity, and you have to have the have to have somebody buy it and buy that electricity for a price. And
so
if you're competing with electric utilities or some of the largest corporations in the world, you as an individual, you as a group of farmers, you generally lose. That's just the way it is. It doesn't work any other way.
Harv, can I ask Paul a couple more questions?
Sure, you can, absolutely.
Yeah, because this is pretty hopeful stuff. So, you know, just for perspective and for, you know, you listeners who, you know, aren't steeped in the numbers the way we are, wind in 2016 produced, I think it's like, was it about 5.5% of U.S. electricity came from wind turbines?
Yeah, I mean, it's more than it was, but it's not enough.
Yeah, okay, but it's getting to be, you know, a respectable,
it's a real
significant number.
Yeah,
definitely a real number. So it won't surprise our listeners to hear that there is in Washington, D.C., a trade association that represents, and Paul, you know, tell me if I'm not getting this entirely right, the builders of the wind turbine equipment, you know, which is the base, the concrete, the towers, the blades, the nacelles, which is those weird sort of
the big box on top,
yes. The big box, yeah, the big sort of spheroid box on top, you know, et cetera. And who else is represented by the American Wind Energy Association?
By those very utility subsidiaries I've been talking about.
Okay. So what is their stance toward a feed-in tariff and other ways to democratize the creation and sale of wind-powered electricity?
Well, I think officially they would probably say, we're not opposed to that, but it will never amount to much, and we've got real things to do, so just move aside, little one, we'll take it over from here. In reality, they would be opposed.
They're terrified. They're terrified.
They would be terrified. Certainly the board of directors would be terrified. That's correct. Yeah.
The utility companies are terrified of wind power that's owned by the communities because that puts them out of business, same as rooftop solar.
Well, except what Paul is saying is that, the entities that would be put out of business, again, check me if I'm missing something. You know, it's not the companies that own the transmission lines. It's not the local distribution companies or LDCs.
It's just the guys that produce the electricity. Yeah.
It's the producer. It's the generators of electricity running on fossil fuels and on nuclear power, or as Harvey unaffectionately calls them, King Kong.
King Kong. Coal, oil, nuclear gas.
Coal, oil, nuclear gas.
The enemy is Solartopia. Yep. And you can read that article at Progressive Magazine that just came out, actually.
So the adversaries, we got to be careful. It's not necessarily everybody who would be lined up against this. But who are the allies, and are there people? Are there organizers? Are there politicians? Are there community leaders who get this idea of community-owned, feed-in, tariff-enabled wind power and are ready to mobilize and legislate behind it?
Yeah, Bernie Sanders was. Bernie Sanders was a great hope. Bernie Sanders in Vermont, there are some examples of community-owned wind turbines. One of Bernie Sanders' kitchen cabinet was a good friend of mine who's a strong component of community ownership and the use of feed-in tariffs as a vehicle to drive that. So if we want to democratize electricity generation, we want to democratize energy in North America, we need something like this, and Bernie was aware of that and he was the only senator supportive of it.
Now, a question about Bernie Sanders, though. During the primary race against Hillary Clinton, we heard Senator Sanders several times, and I personally was thrilled, as you can imagine, to hear him not just say that he was for a federal U.S. carbon tax, but to express it in with such enthusiasm and directness and unapologetically, as if it was the most intelligent and American thing that we could do. It was really a revelation. I didn't hear him, however, on the stump, and maybe I just wasn't listening, advocate for community, owned and controlled and developed wind power and solar power across the United States. And maybe that explains part of how he did so well in the face of the Democratic National Committee and establishment arrayed against him. That would have served him very well in the 2016 elections, right?
Well, I would like to think so, and I was disappointed that he did not make it a front burner issue for him, but it was there. I had spoken to Sanders during my campaign for feed-in tariffs in North America. He was the only senator who bothered to listen to me propose this public policy, and he has people on his advisory staff who understand the principles and are, they're doing it. They're in the field making this happen. So, there was an opportunity to bring this back to the public arena. He didn't do so. But I don't fault Bernie on that. Bernie got us so far. Yeah. And as it was, neoliberal philosophy dominates both mainstream political parties in the United States. And that's basically what we're talking about fighting here is if we want to democratize electricity generation, we want to create a new generation of electricity rebels here in the United States, we have to fight neoliberalism, the whole concept. And this is what Charles has been fighting, trying to bring a carbon tax to the United States. This idea, we can't have a carbon tax because it's going to reduce the economy. And these pseudo crises that we have to keep us distracted, there's so much we need to do. Go ahead.
Let me jump in here. First of all, I want to, the tribe in California that owns the windmills along the ridges in the southern part of the state, east of San Diego and Los Angeles, is the Chumash. It's C-H-U-M-A-S-H. And they have been our allies in fighting the Diablo Canyon nuclear plant and trying to get that monstrous, apocalyptic terror machine shut down. Charles Komenoff, from your wind tunnel there, I would like you to explain to our listeners what the carbon tax is and how that fits in to going to a solartopian 100% renewable-based economy, of which Paul is the primary proponent of the wind section of that.
Well, you know, the premise behind a carbon tax is that the transition away from fossil fuels, which are destroying our climate, our health, and our democracy, is going to take too long unless we can have pricing of fossil fuels, coal, oil, and gas, reflect at least some of the damage that those fuels do to climate, health, and democracy. And politically and conceptually, the easiest way to convey that idea and bring it to political fruition seems to be to just label that kind of fee a carbon tax, to tie it to climate damage, and this fee or this carbon tax would be collected from at all the places that coal is taken out of the ground, oil and gas are taken out of the ground or imported into the United States before or just at the point where they begin their passage through and into the economy, you know, through pipelines and coal trains and trucks, and ultimately get converted either to, you know, gasoline or electricity or the other forms in which fuels are used. And interestingly, there's only about a few thousand places in the economy where that those fuels are pulled out of the ground and into our economic system. So it would be administratively quite easy to implement a carbon tax. And it, yes, it would raise the prices of coal, oil, and gas, and of electricity generated from them. And that's the point, because we've got to create a more level playing field that allows renewable energy, wind and solar, and, of course, energy efficiency to compete and to shove fossil fuels, not gradually, but very quickly, out of the economy and out of our political system. And, you know, we can talk about the handful of countries that have carbon taxes. There's a province in Canada, British Columbia, that has a carbon tax. And, you know, in any place that they've been implemented, the administration process is simple. Carbon use of carbon fuels either goes down or at least it doesn't go up, as in comparable countries or provinces. And clearly this is a way to go to make the economic system work for renewables and efficiency instead of being biased against them.
Okay, that's a pretty good scheme. And so what is the balance, or how do we see wind technology and photovoltaic technology fitting into this? In addition to, you know, we've now seen major breakthroughs in battery technology. And this rap that the wind and solar can't do it for the country because, you know, the wind, there are times when the wind doesn't blow and the sun doesn't shine. We seem to be, and maybe you guys are the experts, on the cutting edge of the moment when battery technology jumps in and we can definitively say that there's no longer an intermittency problem.
Harvey, I wouldn't get caught up in the battery technology or any other kind of storage technology. These have always been kind of a myth about renewable energy, that you need battery. Let's don't develop renewable energy until we develop the batteries. Or that's not really necessary. If you develop a sophisticated mix of renewable resources over a vast landmass like we have in North America, you need very little storage, and you can't make up when renewables can't deliver the peak load, you can do with very simple gas-fired, simple cycle power plants. They're very cheap to build, and you only need to run them a couple hours per year. So you don't have a lot of carbon emissions. You don't have a lot of air pollution, and it's very simple to do. I mean, we have engineers, competent engineers in North America who are fully capable of managing systems like this. The Germans look at going to 80% of their electricity supply with renewable energy, and they don't see a major problem. There are issues. There are technical issues, but you don't need batteries as such. There are lots of other ways to do it without using batteries.
Well, we had a house in Southern California now that I'm going to totally solarize. And, you know, I'm looking for a unified plan for our house. And everyone I've talked to about it says I should have a battery component for backup, because mine's, I'm not going to have wind power on my house in L.A., so it's going to be all solar. I won't have geothermal either. Now, don't you think that on the individual home front that solar will, that battery technology will make a difference?
Sure. If you live on an Eskimo village or you live on a farm where there's no utility line and you want to have electricity, then you need a mix of resources even there. You need some wind and solar, and you need a little backup generator and some batteries. But, no, for somebody who's connected to the grid, you don't need batteries.
Well, I love to disconnect from the grid. I like to point out that my
Okay, well, then you're
going to
need batteries. Yeah.
My neighbors in Los Angeles are not Eskimos. They're Orthodox Jews. Hard to tell them apart, but, you know. So, Charlie, how does the
Harvey, can I just push back gently on what, you know, Paul just said? In the main, I agree with him as sort of a national strategy. But we probably want to tell our listeners the rather cool thing, at least so far as I know about it, that is happening with Aliso Canyon, or in the wake of Aliso Canyon, where the ongoing toxic cloud disaster that was like right out of that Don DeLillo book, what was it called? White Noise. You know, where for what 2 years, thousands of people living in the Porter Ranch section, kind of above Los Angeles, you know, many of them were just getting violently ill and couldn't even stay in their houses because of an ongoing leak of methane and other gases from an underground gas storage facility operated, I guess, by Southern California Edison?
No, I think it was PG&E.
Southern California Gas.
Gas.
And in the way now, one of the implications of that for energy supply was that those peak turbines that that Paul was referring to that can provide that extra boost of electricity during the handful of hours of the year when everybody's running their AC. Well, the gas supply for that is no longer assured because of the loss of that gas storage. So what's happening in its wake is that some of the utilities, and I don't recall which ones, actually organized, and they have built and are about to turn the switch in February, next month, a facility consisting of 19,000 battery modules, which are going to operate out of like a dozen large trailers that are wired together in these racks and are intended to provide, I think, on the order of like 40 megawatts worth of storage that are capable of providing 40 megawatts for 4 hours. Mm-hmm. So let's say from, you know, 4 p.m. to 8 p.m, which might be the peak period there. And that's going to be the biggest full-scale test of utility size battery storage. They're using lithium ion. They got to make sure that these things don't, you know, explode into flames, which has been a problem in some applications. You know, it's not a no-brainer thing. It's a little bit, you know, complicated. But when they turn this on next month, if it really works, then You know, I'm not saying that the final roadblock will be cleared, and I respect what Paul said that, again, on a large, you know, statewide or nationwide, grid-wide basis, there's so much geographical diversity from renewable energy that we don't have to worry obsessively over this so-called variability issue. But this is going to be bringing, hopefully, large-scale, utility-scale battery storage onto the utility grid, and, you know, it's just going to push the envelope further and further weaken the arguments being made by the opponents of renewable energy. It's going to be, another big step in the inevitable march that we've got to make even faster, where renewables and efficiency can shove King Kong out of our, out of our energy system.
Well, absolutely. And I think what Charles mentioned, that why that this is important, Harvey, is that we have to move faster. And what we've accomplished in North America, it makes us feel good. We see wind turbines and solar panels all across the United States and Canada today. But the pace of growth is just not fast enough to address climate change. That's why we need a carbon tax that Charles has been working on diligently for a decade or more, and we need more aggressive renewable energy policy. And, of course, I argue that that aggressive renewable energy policy has to include the support of the people. Some of those people voted for Donald Trump, but they have a right to wind energy, and they have a right to solar energy just like us liberals do, too. So I wanted to compliment the people of New York. I heard a rumor yesterday that Indian Point is going to close.
Yes,
well, Charlie's in New York. It's not going to close soon enough, and unfortunately, the governor, Andrew Cuomo, wants to take, it's not a done deal, $7.6 perfectly good $1 billion and throw them down the toilet to support the continued operation of reactors upstate. And this is an utter insanity.
Okay, and, but Harvey, I want to take you to task on that, because while I disagree that I agree that that's a waste of money paying to operate the reactor, which has already been paid for, the principle that Cuomo has stated there and the principle that the state of New York has stated there is we will pay for the electricity because we have concluded there's some kind of societal need for this electricity. And that's all I have been arguing for in this program. If you want renewable energy, and you want renewable energy owned by the people, then you have to pay for it. Set the price and then get out of the way. Let us do it. And that's what's not being done in the United States. It's not being done in Canada. It needs to be done. And whether Cuomo realized he was doing it or not, he set a precedent in New York State.
Yeah, yeah. And Harvey, just to put a fine point on what Paul said, the value – And by the way, I do think that there are some aspects of Cuomo's subsidy for the upstate nukes that are that can be improved upon. And maybe we'll get a chance to talk about that because I've been writing about that, but not publishing yet. I'm still working on it. But the heart of the policy is to provide the owners and operators of those upstate nuclear plants a benefit or a monetary recognition. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Of the zero carbon aspect of the nuclear electricity that they are generating. And I know that there are some things in what I just said that are not going to go down very well with you, Harvey. You know, some, valiant anti-nuke people cling to the belief that nuclear power results in a lot of carbon emissions, you know, even at the power plant, and that's just, you know, not the case. But the encouraging thing, potentially encouraging thing, if we can move the politics of it, is that Cuomo, the governor of New York State, is proposing to monetize and recognize the climate value of zero carbon production of energy or electricity in this case. Now, he's only doing it for the nukes. What he ought to be doing it for is for renewables and energy efficiency. So as you can tell, I'm sort of talking about an electricity carbon tax, a carbon tax for the electricity sector only in New York State, And we're going to try, and, you know, we've got our work cut out for us, to see if we can get the zero energy or zero emission credit, which is what Cuomo's people call the monetary value for the upstate nukes, zero carbon, if we can get that generalized to everything that is low or no carbon in the state of New York.
And that
okay,
is the
so
avenue.
Charlie, well, I'm going to jump here and hear on that, as you guess I might. First of all, the nuclear power is technically not zero carbon. All nuclear reactors do emit a certain amount of carbon 14. So
no, is, carbon we're talking carbon dioxide, Harvey. That's
well,
the stuff
but it's,
that,
it's
that
still
gets
carbon.
That gets, you know, carbon is not a problem. It's the carbon dioxide, which of course is from combusting those darn fossil fuels.
Yes, and of course the fuel for a nuclear plant does require all
right,
carbon emissions.
Harvey,
anyway.
I just want to say we can get caught up in the purity of this, and that's why I think the environmental community missed an opportunity in New York, and I'm glad to see that Charles is working on this, because I tried something a few years ago in the state of Indiana, where I learned that the corrupt government, Mitch Daniels, a Republican, now the president of Purdue University, got a nice cushy, that's what they do in Indiana, give them nice cushy positions, had a sweetheart deal with a Duke Energy coal gasification plant in southern Indiana, and they paid him a fixed price for the electricity that would be produced by the power plant. So they got a feed-in tariff in the state of Indiana for a coal gasification plant. And I advise the environmental community in Indiana, you need to go to the governor and say, well, you've done it for this polluting coal plant. You should at least do the same thing for renewable energy. They never did, because it just violated the whole purity of their campaign against the power plant. And they just focused on shutting down the power plant rather than turning aside and trying to develop renewable energy in the state.
Well, I think that people are certainly in New York are working to get this turned around. I don't agree at all with subsidizing nuclear plants in any way, shape, or form, and they're doing it in Illinois. They're trying to do it here in Ohio. They may even try to do it for Diablo Canyon. You never know, because there was a deal cut, and but all these deals are fluid, especially when you got the art of the deal in the White House. So the bottom line here is not only do nuclear plants in my world emit carbon all through the fuel cycle, but they also emit huge quantities of waste heat.
Harvey, let me put a question to you.
Yeah. One of the arguments that we want to use that, I mean, I have not got a precise how many 100 million gallons of heated water per megawatt, but it is substantial. And we certainly know that solar cells and windmills do not emit huge quantities of waste heat, and they also don't kill marine life. And I will also
Harvey,
add,
probably
way,
everybody one, listening
sorry,
to
not
you.
Quite down here. Yeah, but not quite down here. And one of the arguments we also hear, with which Paul is certainly familiar, is the idea that windmills kill birds. And which we know is to a certain extent true, but we also know that cooling towers from nuclear plants kill birds, and of course the waste heat kills huge numbers of marine life. So we'll put that in the equation as well. But Charlie, go ahead, jump in.
Yeah, I'm sorry, because the question I want to put to you, and I kind of feel maybe we've talked about this before, but maybe not, is, you know, if there is going to be in your state or in our nation at some point a proposed carbon tax that is a straight-up fee on carbon dioxide emissions from burning coal, oil, and gas. You know, will you support that, even though that would improve the competitive position of nuclear power plants vis-a-vis fossil fuels?
Well, that doesn't concern me, as long as we're dealing with fossil fuels versus nuclear power. I don't care about fossil fuels versus nuclear power. They all got to go. What I care about is fossil fuels and nuclear power versus renewables. And in renewables, you know, we don't have a carbon problem. And we also don't have a waste heat problem. So if you're going to do a carbon tax, seems to me there should also be a cause that accounts for heat emissions,
because heat emissions from nuclear power from all thermal plants are substantial and
okay.
a serious
Harvey?
Problem.
Harvey, let me jump in here. I mean, that's something we can argue about as well. If you want to have a penalty for thermal emissions, that's okay. But what Charles is getting at is a very important point, and this was something that actually was used in practice in Great Britain, United Kingdom, during the Thatcher era. And I know we're all old enough to remember Margaret Thatcher. And Maggie wanted
well,
to...
Well, she's
to,
come back. Margaret Thatcher is back.
Yeah, from the grave, absolutely, yeah. Well, she wanted to support nuclear power in Britain and privatize the Central Electricity Generating Board, but she had to protect nuclear power. And so to do so, she had to fix the price that it would be paid so that they'd be assured that the nuclear power plants could operate and operate safely. And she established, her government established, a non-fossil fuel obligation. Notice those words, Harvey, non-fossil fuel obligation. That meant nuclear power, but it also meant renewable energy. She didn't know that at the time. But suddenly the guys at the windmill stood up and said, oh, non-fossil fuel, we're non-fossil fuel as well. And so that was the first feed-in tariff launched in Great Britain, was to support nuclear power, but it benefited launching the wind energy industry in Great Britain.
And Paul, are you gonna finish that thought by pointing out the amazing results in Great Britain in 2016? You probably know this better than I do, where for one thing, or maybe this is, it says it all, the amount of electricity produced in the United Kingdom last year from wind turbines exceeded electricity production from coal-fired power plants, which, you know, and the image, think of the images that the three of us and many of our listeners grew up with, of thinking of, you know, the birth of the industrial age and of electricity production in Great Britain with smoke-belching coal-fired power plants. And those have now been pushed down by the economics, and part of it is because of, I guess, what used to be a kind of feed-in tariff, if you will, and now I think is a kind of carbon tax in the United Kingdom. Coal, King Coal, can no longer compete in Great Britain, and wind power is now outstripping it.
Yeah, King
right.
Coal,
unfortunately,
Harvey,
unfortunately,
is dead in Great Britain.
What is?
King Coal is dead
King
in
Coal.
Great Britain.
Yes, unfortunately, the Brits, under Theresa May, the rebirth of Margaret Thatcher, I'm waiting for her to attack Argentina now, that they're pushing ahead with the Hinkley nuclear plant.
Yes, I know. I mean, it's not all good, Harvey, but we do
insane.
Have to look at these small victories to see the direction that we want to go and what the British accomplished before Theresa May took power is truly astounding. We didn't think the Brits were capable of it, but they showed what can happen when you have an unlimited feed-in tariff that paid a fair price. They have like 16,000 megawatts of photovoltaic solar cells, Harvey, in Great Britain. Now, when was the last time you were in Great Britain and saw the sun?
Well, the same in Germany now. Of course, it's
exactly.
Fox News, as Fox News reported, that it's much easier for Germany to go solar because they have so much more sunlight than we do here in the United States. But nonetheless, I do, by the way, before we lose track, I want to congratulate the Williams sisters, you at the Women's March, Charlie, getting into the finals of the Australian Open tennis. I watched Venus Williams last night and a bit of Serena. It is a truly amazing accomplishment for those two women. I can't let this go by. This will probably be the last time they played each other in a major final match. And I'm also hoping that Rafa Nadal wins today. It will be an AK All-Star game between the four of them.
Against Roger Federer. Who are you going to root for? Which sister are you going to root for, Harvey?
Venus.
Me too.
I think because she's older, and I don't think she'll. She has. I think Serena has a better chance of making another final than Venus does. And I got to say, one of the most beautiful things I have ever seen was Venus's victory dance. If you haven't seen Venus' victory dance, anybody listening, go to YouTube and watch the victory dance she did at the end of the Australian semifinal. It was astounding. She is absolutely, those two women are so gorgeous. Oh, no, we're at the end. Listen, I'm going to have you guys back.
Yeah, so, thanks, Harvey. We'll thanks,
again.
Charles.
Charlie, and, okay. And it's a great way to end. We'll have you back, and we'll do it again.
Okay. Thank you, Paul. Great hooking up with you again.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay,
we'll all talk bye-bye. Again
keep
soon.
Up. Super. Bye now. Bye-bye.
Solar Tropia, Solar Tropia, Solar Tropia.